Many years ago, settlers were looking for a kind and gentle place to put down roots. They came upon a valley that was fed by streams flowing down from the mountains in the east and the mountains in the west. The valley, because of its fertile soil and abundant water, made it ideal for growing crops and raising livestock. On clear days, the settlers could look down the valley to the north and see a lone snow-capped peak standing way off in the distance. Eventually, small settlements began to spring up along the valley floor, nestled in the valley between two sets of mountain chains running north and south. The settlements appeared from the south all the way to the north, along a burgeoning trade route. With a large body of water to the west that was fed by mountain streams and rivers, as I said, the area proved all anyone could ever need to provide for a family and more. As time passed, one town began to grow above the others. As usual, the town's name became the dominant icon. And someone outside the area would simply need to utter its name or hear its name, and people would recognize the locale immediately. The name of the dominant community is one all of us know very well as well. Sodom. How did Sodom become Sodom? Because when we hear the word Sodom, what we may think about is probably not what we actually should think about. Because I think when we hear the word Sodom and we refer to that story in Scripture, we may not fill in all the details in our minds. We think about Sodom, there may be a lot left that we need to be thinking about in regards to Sodom, that we automatically attach one particular thing to that town. Another question we should ask is, what made Sodom, Sodom? What made Sodom, Sodom? Let's digress a moment. What's a byword? You know what a byword is. The definition of a byword is a person or a thing cited as notorious or an outstanding example or embodiment of something. Hercules, for instance. When we say someone gave a Herculean effort, we know what that means. We picture strength, right? The Greek mythology, the story of Hercules. Or if someone is a snake, we call them a snake. He's thought to be crafty or sneaky or deceitful. When the word Sodom is used, people all across the globe know that this word carries with it a form of sexual deviation. It's how we identify. But should the city of Sodom and its biblical story be identified by this meaning? Was sexual immorality the reason for Sodom's destruction? Now, we can read the story of Sodom in Genesis, and we can see how God chose to deal with them, yet it doesn't really answer the question I asked. How did Sodom become Sodom? And what made Sodom, Sodom? One of the things that I think we know, but we need to rehearse, is that few things in life just happen. As I've mentioned from the pulpit before, there is always a backstory to the things that we see happening. People, conditions, and decisions that converge to bring about a particular event, have substance to them, a story, a progression that arrived at the outcome that we witness. I think you see where I'm going. Sodom just didn't happen. It had a cause. So we're going to look at that cause, and we're going to investigate not only what the cause was, but also how Scripture can audit, if you will, our preconceived understanding of Sodom as a byword in our minds. There's a biblical answer to the question we've asked concerning Sodom. The story of Sodom and what God says to his people about it creates a sobering parallel for us in our own time. Let's turn to Ezekiel 16. Now we'll get to the story of Lot and Abraham a little bit later, but let's go to Ezekiel 16, where from the first verse to the last verse here in Ezekiel 16, God is chastising Judah. And he's chastising Judah for her infidelity. But God mentions Sodom because he tells Judah that they have a sister to the north, Israel, Samaria, and they have a sister to the south, Sodom. And he says, you have two sisters that have become extinct and have been removed, and I am equally unhappy with you as I was with them. So with this in our minds now, let's begin reading how Sodom became Sodom. In Ezekiel 16, all the way down to verse 44, we'll begin. It says, indeed, everyone who quotes Proverbs will use this proverb against you, like mother, like daughter. So we have a very similar common statement, like father, like son, right? Like mother, like daughter. You are your mother's daughter, loathing husband and children, and you are the sister of your sisters who loathed their husbands and children. Your mother was a Hittite and your father an Amorite. Your elder sister is Samaria, who dwells with her daughters to the north of you, and your younger sister, who dwells to the south of you, is Sodom and her daughters. You did not walk in their ways, nor act according to their abominations, but as if that were too little, you became more corrupt than they in all your ways. As I live, said the Lord God, neither your sister Sodom nor her daughters have done as you and your daughters have done. So God's using some historical people that Judah would have certainly understood to drive home a point. As awful and sinful as these two people and situations were, you have become even more corrupt than they did, and I destroyed them for that corruption. So what God's saying to Judah. Now God tells us how Sodom became Sodom. In verse 49, look, this was the iniquity of your sister Sodom. She and her daughter had pride, fullness of food, and abundance of idleness. Neither did she strengthen the hand of the poor and the needy. And in verse 50, and they were haughty and committed abomination before me. Therefore, I took them away as I saw fit. In these two verses, God tells us how Sodom became Sodom. Everything God said is, of course, accurate, but to properly understand what he said and why he said it, this will take a little bit of investigation today. God just hit the highlights for conversation's sake with Judah, and he was speaking to a people who would have a very real idea of what the byword Sodom would bring with it. But we need to know why God was angry and comparing Judah to Sodom and what that meant. God doesn't get angry like we do. He doesn't start spouting off random accusations, blaming someone for something that maybe they didn't do just out of anger and spite. God doesn't do that. When God says something, you can be assured that he means it, and it's not random. So what did God say to them first? He said, "You have pride." Now, pride has a range, doesn't it? I mean, even today, we in the church, we hear the word pride, and we try to find another word to use because it has a range. It ranges from appropriate, personal satisfaction of a job well done, to a real disgusting self-aggrandizement, I'm better than you type superiority attitude. It has a full spectrum. Sodom, as I said, was in a very advantageous location. And the location in regard to other cities through the valley and its natural resources lent itself to being able to enjoy the good life. They were there in the valley between the mountains and the Dead Sea. They had beautiful pasture land. There was a long trade route that went up along the Dead Sea and all the settlements, and Sodom was in this advantageous position, and they enjoyed the good life. Sodom had a type of pride that had turned into arrogance. Now, this comes about somewhat naturally. The second thing that God accused them of, that they had fullness of bread. Now, fullness of bread speaks to having, really no need. Your needs are all met and then some, right? Fullness of bread. It leads to eventually trading what your surpluses are. And if you don't have some things in your area, if you've got surplus, if you've got fullness of bread, if you've got more grain and more of sheep and oxen that you need, then you would trade those. And you would get those things that you want because your needs are met. So it leads to the finer things in life, an acquisition of wealth. The building of wealth brings more and more luxurious items. The standard of living begins to rise. The expectation of the standard of living begins to rise. The desire and hunger for more luxuries leads to more exotic possessions. And this is the hamster wheel, if you will, that you can get on in regard to this. So the search for things that tickle the senses and drive the desires keep getting more and more outlandish. And as I'm saying this, I know it's natural for us to begin to compare to what we see today. The third thing that God mentioned is abundance of idleness. So they had reached a place where their wealth had given them more time than they knew what to do with. Now, couple that with the attitude of arrogance, superiority, and their needs and wants being fulfilled to the point where they were looking for something more to satisfy them. This is a recipe for disaster. We've heard the statement, idle hands are the devil's playground. We've probably all heard that. It's actually derived from a verse in Proverbs 16:27. It's poetic license that someone took out of the King James. An ungodly man or a worthless man digs up evil or plots evil. That's where that comes from. It doesn't take a parent really too long to understand this particular principle. All of us that have been parents, when you have a few young children and they're playing in the back bedroom and you're sitting in the living room and it gets quiet, you know you better get up and go back there. When you're sitting on the couch and that happens, you know what you're pretty much going to find in that room. It's not going to be them doing something they're supposed to. Idle hands. As a society becomes bored with the norm, we begin to look for entertainment. Many of us, have a pretty good knowledge of the Roman Empire and how that empire existed. They had coliseums, huge coliseums for blood sport. They had huge public bathhouses where you could get anything your heart desired, including a bath. This is a good representation of any, but we probably have some modern ones that come into our mind of what pride, fullness of bread, and idleness produces in a society. And Sodom, God says to Judah, had these things attached to them. The fourth thing that he accuses them of is, neither did she strengthen the hand of the poor. So they had no regard for those in need. The homeless were something just to brush aside. Those people in need, in hunger, or for clothing, or for just the needs of life, they didn't have time for them. They were an embarrassment. God said those in need were just simply ignored. The poor had become part of society. They had just soon go away. They'd like it just to go away. So while Sodom enjoyed the good life, the poor were simply a nuisance to Sodom. Fifth thing God mentioned was they were haughty. They had arrived at the point in this digression, if you will, that in their minds they had reached the self-deception of believing they were where they were because they deserved to be there. To say they thought of themselves as highly, higher than they thought they should would be an understatement. God calls them haughty. They had reached a level of arrogance and self-exaltation that made them rise above the other evildoers on the earth, and God had taken notice of Sodom. He had taken notice. Now, all of these five iniquities that God lists as Sodom's path to its demise lead us to the sixth one. The only one that most people assign to Sodom, and the one we think of when the word Sodom is used as a byword. The sixth, committed abomination before me. Now, people attach this iniquity, and most of the time only this iniquity, to Sodom, and this particular sexual sin running rampant makes Sodom Sodom. And it's not just this sin that makes Sodom who it was. The abominations committed before God in Sodom were the culmination of this progressive list of perverse iniquities that led the city of Sodom to this place. God said, therefore I took them away as I saw fit. They had reached this level of progression to evil that God could no longer allow them to exist. The fact that most humanity does not recognize the progressive nature to get to the byword Sodom is both damning and eye-opening. For those that take what God is presenting to Judah here in Ezekiel 16 and overlay it on our own society today. Sodom is thought to be the obvious example or byword of sexual immorality. But we err in thought and conclusion if we think immorality means just sexual sin, adultery, fornication, sexual assault, abuse, sodomy, etc. Immorality is not conforming to God's standard of decent moral behavior. Moral behavior that He sets, guidelines He teaches. Immorality was not the end result of Sodom's progression. Immorality was Sodom's progression. There's a lady named Claire Luce. She was an American author, a politician, U.S. ambassador, and a public conservative figure. She was born in 1903. She passed in 1987. She served in the House of Representatives during the Second World War, wrote over 100 speeches for President Dwight Eisenhower. Claire became the first American woman appointed to a major ambassador post abroad. She served in Italy following the war. She was well known during her time in Italy to the Pope, and the Pope even referred to her as a friend. She was a very influential woman. Later, she served as an ambassador to Brazil, and she became a playwright and a very famous author. She authored a book called "Is the New Morality Destroying America?" And I'm going to read some excerpts, and they are excerpts, but I'm going to read some excerpts from her book because I believe really, really fits nicely into what we're talking about today. She says, "Morals, the dictionary tells us, are a set of principles of right action and behavior for the individual. The traditional morality of any given society is a set of moral principles to which the great majority of its members have subscribed over a good length of time. It is the consensus which any given society has reached on what right action and decent behavior are for everybody. It is the way that society expects a person to behave, even when the law, the civil law, does not require him or her to do so. One example will have to suffice," she says. "There is no law that requires a person to speak the truth, unless he is under an oath to do so in a court proceeding. A person can, with legal impunity, be a habitual liar. The traditional morality of our society, however, takes a dim view of a habitual liar. Accordingly, society punishes him in the only way it can, by social ostracism." So she stated morality is what the majority, by consensus, over a long period of time, have determined to be the proper conduct for a body of people. And even when the law may allow something different, the society will simply ostracize that individual or that group by choosing to just not fellowship with them or be around them. When we look at the description of Sodom that God gave in Ezekiel, it's not a stretch for us to envision Sodom beginning as a moral community. Settlers coming in, setting up their farms, people beginning to gather in a central place to sell those goods, buildings being built. Before all the process of decline referred to in Ezekiel 16, 49 and 50, they had some, most likely they had some common morality that all communities have. What are the traits that identify morality? Well, Claire Booth continues. She says, there is indeed a universal morality. It knows no race, no geographical boundaries, no time, and no particular religion. When we study the history of human thought, we discover a truly remarkable thing. All the great minds of the world have agreed on the marks of the moral person. In all civilizations, in all ages, they have hailed truthfulness as a mark of morality. Veracity, said Thomas Huxley, the English scientist, is the heart of morality. In Judeo-Christian lore, the devil's other name is the liar. Another mark of the moral person is honesty. The moral person is just. Disraeli called justice truth in action. The moral person is honorable at whatever cost to himself, including sometimes his very life. He does his duty by his family, his job, his country. If in the hour of weakness the moral man does a thing he knows to be wrong, he confesses it, and he takes his punishment like a soldier. And if he harms another, even inadvertently, he tries to make restitution. He takes responsibility for his own actions. And if it turns out badly for him, he does not put the blame on others. He does not, for example, yield to the post-Freudian moral cop-out of blaming his follies and failures, his weakness and vices, on the way his parents treated him in childhood. Absolute morality, she continues, wrote the English philosopher Herbert Spencer, is the regulation of conduct in such a way that pain will not be inflicted. The moral person is kind to the weak and compassionate with those who suffer. So we see a listing of behaviors here that she talks about that is across national and ethnic borders, across societies, all through religions, and down through the ages. These identifiers have been accepted by a broad range of people and a mark of a moral individual. Sodom was becoming immoral long before they arrived at the point of Genesis 19, where God sent the two angels down to its gates to visit and assess its condition and to see Lot. Sodom had become immoral by that time. What pushed Sodom over the edge? What was the tipping point, if you will, for Sodom? A moral person is courageous. Courage is what preserves lives, homes, parents, children, and country. That's what, again, we're back to reading part of Claire Luce's book here. There is also one moral precept, she says, that is common to all great religions of history. It is called the Golden Rule. Do unto others as you would have them do to you. The universal morality is based on these virtues: truthfulness, honesty, duty, responsibility, unselfishness, loyalty, honor, compassion, and courage. Now, if all these virtues do indeed represent the universal morality, then what do their opposites represent? Well, lying, dishonesty, dereliction of duty, irresponsibility, dishonorable conduct, disloyalty, selfishness, cowardice, cruelty, and hypocrisy, and of course, the universal immorality. So how did Sodom become Sodom? The progression of all of these immoral attributes, not just the sexual deviant ones, but all of those immoral attributes. As the speaker said, or the writer said, there is a universal moralities that mark the successful individuals and societies, just as there are these immoralities that mark failed individuals and failed societies. What was it that pushed Sodom over the brink? Well, it was cumulative. They just accumulated and continued to push. All history bears witness to the fact that there can be no public virtue without private morality. Claire writes, all history bears witness to the fact that there can be no public virtue without private morality. When those of us who were reading Genesis 18 and 19 in the Bible reading program, and we read the discussion God had with Abraham concerning Sodom and Lot, and then God's visit to Sodom, I doubt we thought of that account in these terms, that there needs to be private morality in order for there to be public virtue. But I can tell you God thought of that. God knows that principle. Without being there, we don't always recognize and understand the underlying threads. Turn to Genesis 18, if you would. We're going to go back there and read some of this. What was Abraham's final conversation with Christ about Sodom? I think most of us probably remember. Those of us who just read through it, we've rehearsed it recently. And we break into the event here where Christ and some of the angels have showed up at Abraham's tent door and on their way to Sodom to investigate what's going on there. They had heard some things. They were going down to see for themselves. In Genesis 18 and verse 16, then the men rose from there and looked toward Sodom, and Abraham went with them to send them on their way. So if you remember, if we back up, Abraham saw them, recognized that who they were, fixed them a meal. There was this long conversation about Abraham's blessing. He was going to have a son. And this led into now this point where they had gotten up now and they were heading for Sodom. And the Lord said, shall I hide from Abraham what I'm doing? Hey, that's interesting. We get a chance to kind of sneak into God's head there a little bit. Shall I hide from Abraham what I'm doing? Since Abraham shall surely become a great and mighty nation, and all the nations of the earth shall be blessed in him. For I have known him in order that he may command his children and his household after him, that they keep the way of the Lord, to do righteousness and justice, that the Lord may bring to Abraham what he has spoken to him. You know, Christ understood the measure of the man he was dealing with. And he reasoned in his mind that Abraham was a trustworthy individual. He was an individual that he was going to bless for generations. He was going to build a nation out of. It was someone that deserved a level of transparency on what Christ was about to do next. So in verse 20, and the Lord said, because the outcry against Sodom and Gomorrah is great, and because their sin is very grave, I will go down now and see whether they have done altogether according to the outcry against it that has come to me. And if not, I will know. Now what happens next is a plea, we know, from Abraham concerning the subject of private morality. Verse 22, then the men turned away from there and went toward Sodom, but Abraham still stood before the Lord. So you get the sense that he's standing in front of him. But he still has something on his mind. Abraham came near and said, would you also destroy the righteous for the wicked? Suppose there were 50 righteous within the city. Would you also destroy the place and not spare it for the 50 righteous that were in it? Far be it from you to do such a thing as this, to slay the righteous with the wicked, so that the righteous should be as the wicked. Far be it from you. Shall not the judge of all the earth do right? Abraham's reasoning with God here. Verse 26, so the Lord said, if I find in Sodom 50 righteous within the city, then I'll spare all the place for their sakes. Then Abraham answered and said, and we know the routine now, indeed now, I, who am but dust and ashes, have taken it upon myself to speak to the Lord. So, I'm not done yet. And he goes on in the next few verses to say 45. Okay, what about 40? How about 30? What if there's 20? And there's this negotiation that's going on. And in Genesis 18:32, then he said, let not the Lord be angry, and I will speak but once more. Suppose 10 should be found there. And he said, I will not destroy it for the sake of 10. So the Lord went his way as soon as he had finished speaking to Abraham, and Abraham returned to his place. Abraham said to Christ, if you can find 10 privately moral individuals, will you spare the public? Remember, I read what Claire wrote. All history bears witness to the fact that there can be no public virtue without private morality. There can be no decent society unless the majority of the individuals in it are at least trying to be a moral people. You know, God bends over backwards to display his virtues. And time again down through history, he has chosen mercy and practiced patience and granted grace. Yet there is coming a time, isn't there, when the majority of the people on this planet will not be a moral people. A time that our Bible study group read in Genesis 6 and 7, where humanity arrived at a place where God judged there was but one righteous man on the earth, Noah. Remember that story? We're familiar with how that ended. A society or a nation that is abandoning these inherent principles of goodness, these moralities that keep a society functioning and healthy, when they're abandoning these, that's troubling. But when these are not just cast aside like old has-been ideas, but immoral behavior is purposeful and calculated like we read in Genesis 19, that's really troubling. Genesis 19 and verse 4, "Now before they lay down, the men of the city, the men of Sodom, both old and young, all the people from every quarter, surrounded the house. And they called to Lot and said to him, 'Where are the men who came to you tonight? Bring them out to us that we may know them.'" Now the commentaries point us to a few other scriptural references to kind of build what this is talking about. They point us to Isaiah 3, 8, and 9. And that reads, "Jerusalem staggers, Judah is falling, their words and deeds are against the Lord, defying his glorious presence. The look on their face testifies against them. They parade their sin like Sodom. They do not hide it. Woe to them. They have brought disaster upon themselves." When the immoral become the normal, and there is a sense of pride to their immoral actions, welcome to Sodom. What's the primary sign of a society going over the edge? Well, in Sodom's case, God deemed that there was enough private morality, that there wasn't enough private morality to hold up the public. And so God's decision was to take Lot and his family out. Claire Luce continues. She says, "There is one more phenomenon in our society which has historically made its appearance in all decaying societies, an obsession with sex. Sex, the procreative urge, is a mighty force. Indeed, it is the mightiest force. It is the life force. But since the dawn of history, what has distinguished man from beast is that he has made conscious efforts to control his lustful impulses and to regulate and direct them into social channels. There is no primitive society known to anthropologists, no civilization known to historians, which has ever willingly consented to give its members full rein, bestial rein, of their sexual impulses. Sex morals, mores, and manners have varied enormously from age to age and culture to culture. But sexual taboos and no-nos, sex prohibitions, and consequently, of course, inhibitions, are common to all human societies. Now, the fact that mankind had instinctively sensed that there is a right and wrong of handling his procreative energies strongly suggests that there may be a universal sexual morality. And so there is. And when we examine it, we find that it is this very morality that has made all human progress and what we call civilization possible. It is the morality that protects and preserves the basic unit of society, the family. The family is the foundation on which mankind has built all his societies. What we've been living in and witnessing is the systematic progression to global moral implosion and an inevitable judgment, inevitable judgment by God to end this earth's misery. Let's finish up in Genesis 19. You know, I find it incredibly encouraging, brethren, to read of Lot and how God dealt with him. Because certainly he was headed to Sodom to assess the situation and then pass judgment. And yet, his dealings with Lot are incredibly merciful. In verse 10 of Genesis 19, but then the men inside, so the crowd is saying, send out those men that came in. We want them. And Lot's trying to keep them from coming in the house. He says, but the men or the angels inside reached out, pulled Lot back into the house and shut the door. Then they struck the men who were at the door of the house, young and old, with blindness, so they could not find the door. Two men then said to Lot, do you have anyone else here? Sons-in-law, daughters, or sons or daughters, or anyone else in the city who belongs to you? Get them out of here, because we're going to destroy this place. Now, I'm reading from the NIV, I believe, on these scriptures. The outcry to the Lord against its people is so great that he has sent us to destroy it. So Lot went out and spoke to his sons-in-law, who were pledged to marry his daughters, and he said, hurry and get out of this place, because the Lord is about to destroy the city. But his sons-in-law thought he was joking. Verse 15, with the coming of dawn, the angels urged Lot, saying, hurry, take your wife and your two daughters who are here, or you will be swept away when the city is punished. When he hesitated, the men grasped his hand and the hands of his wife and his two daughters and led them safely out of the city, for the Lord was merciful to them. As soon as they had brought them out, one of them said, flee for your lives. Run. Don't look back, and don't stop anywhere in the plain. So the whole plain. Flee to the mountains, or you will be swept away. But Lot said to them, no, my Lord, please. Your servant has found favor in your eyes, and you have shown great kindness to me in sparing my life, but I can't flee to the mountains. This disaster will overtake me, and I'll die. So a little bit of fear by Lot. Look, here is a town near enough to run to, and it's small. Let me flee to it. It is very small, isn't it? Then my life will be spared. And the angel said to him, very well, I will grant you this request too. I will not overthrow the town you speak of, but flee there quickly, because I cannot do anything until you reach it. You know, we're familiar with that story. But like I said at the beginning, it's incredibly encouraging to me. Not the story of Sodom being destroyed, but the story of how God is so merciful to Lot. Day of Trumpets for us each year is a rehearsal of a time when God has reached a place with society, with the world, where he's had enough with its immoralities, much like Sodom. Lot and his wife were invested in the place that they lived, so much so that he drug his feet and the angels had to remove him. Lot's wife, as we know, was more attached than Lot was, and it cost her. Yet by the next two verses, just the very next two verses, Sodom was gone. Prophetically, by the time we get to Trumpets, where we live doesn't exist. The progression of Sodom's immorality should stand as a more proper byword in our minds. The hesitation of Lot and the longing of his wife should be a warning to us, and how entrenched and how attached we can become to the things around us that are fleeting. They have a timestamp. The swiftness of Sodom's destruction should bring some added resolve to our calling. the love God has for those of us who seek Him, no matter the place, no matter the station of life we're in, is unmatched. And we can enjoy a great amount of comfort and peace when we live the kind of life that brings that kind of blessing from God. As God finishes His parallel of Israel and Judah with Sodom in Ezekiel 16, in verse 56, God says something significant. He says in Ezekiel 16, 56, "For your sister Sodom was not a byword in your mouth in the days of your pride." He said, "You Israel, you Judah, in your prideful immorality, did not remember how Sodom became Sodom." Claire Luce ends the speech that she gave in 1976, which the book is The New Morality Destroying America includes. And she says, she ended her speech in this way. She said, "When Goethe, the great German poet, lay on his deathbed, an old friend asked him what farewell message he had to give to the world. And he replied, 'Let every man keep his own household clean, and soon the whole world will be clean.'"